This is an example of speech.
All our history of broiling wars.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge, thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blow hard, redacted evergreen topical heatwave of a weekly conversation turned podcast, in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment section in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis. And I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at Green_Weird, which is WYRD. This episode, we have our weekly intro segment, Week Thoughts, in which we discuss Kim Jong-un's recent trip to China, what a progressive American foreign policy might look like, a grown-up book report of The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu by Joshua Hammer, and much more. Prepare to get royally revolutionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now for some Week Thoughts.
With a shake and a smirk, centralized states can turn a blind eye. Those who benefit never ask why. Just sit back and enjoy some cocoa beans and don't wonder what profit really means.
Welcome to Weak Thoughts.
Waste your life with a stronger
think.
Power.
All that reduced to please so fucking. Make sure to support our podcast as if your life depends on it.
Like, subscribe,
share, and
you know, give us a few hours of your life, and instead of wages, you'll get nothing but our highest esteem and love.
Yes. Comment, and review, yeah, all of that.
Even if it's terrible, tell us how much you hate us.
Yes. Give us 5 stars and then just rip us to shreds. You want to talk about North Korea a bit.
Oh, right. So, yeah, there was some, like, Kim took the slow train to Beijing at a, you know, a whopping 37 miles an hour. No wonder it was filled with wine and karaoke. Well, that was allegedly by his father, but, yeah.
That old of wine?
Well, I mean, why not? The guy has so much money and apparently a taste for wines. Probably had a good selection, but yeah, it's just so armored.
Really?
That, oh, I mean, why would, there's no way, even in China, that the North Korean dictator would just be, like, sitting open on a train. Because it's, yeah.
Why don't they take why wouldn't he take a plane?
Because he could shoot it down. And North Korea doesn't, I don't think they have a private jet fleet. I mean, I know they have their own national airline, but yeah. Even, like, none of the Kims have ever taken a plane.
Wow. I mean, you can just shoot a bomb at a train.
Yeah, but it's not going to fall out of the sky and guarantee death.
Okay, yeah. Interesting.
And it's so armored, it can probably take it.
Does it come with, like,
a military escort, or? No.
Okay.
Well, probably, so the north, not after the Chinese border.
Mm-hmm. So anyways, he went to, to Beijing?
Right, you went to Beijing and had a nice photo op with Xi Jinping, and a lot of people are like, oh, this means this bodes poorly for any potential U.S. and North Korean talks. It's like, no, this bodes incredibly well for any potential U.S. and North Korean talks.
So can you, first explain, even though it's not what you think, but why that someone would say it isn't?
Because, well, a lot of the pundits and articles that I read surrounding it thought that it will cause Kim to harden his stance against the United States because he's got so much Chinese support to say, F you, America, I've got all the fucking negotiating space in this. But that's not really what it was about.
Okay, yeah, so what is it about?
Well, think about it. For the past, like, what, 70 years now, the North Korean government has been sponsored, if not outright supported, like, diplomatically, financially, economically, by the Chinese government for one very valuable strategic purpose in that they want to keep a buffer between American or Western or whatever you want to call it troops and their own border. And if Korea were to unify, that would throw all of that into question. And so, even so, if picture this, like, we can game this out a little bit. Say you're like the North Korean dictator, and you wanted to get any kind of room in these negotiations, like even potentially unify Korea, you would have to go to the Chinese and get their, make sure that they were on board with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, what's worse, that the whole country collapses without Chinese support, or, you know, like they were kind of threatening to do with the other Kim brother, like, they changed the government to make sure that their policies are continued.
So, jumping forward a bit, you think that Un, wait, should I call him Un or Kim?
I can just call him Kim.
Kim got the okay from the Chinese to have bilateral talks with the U.S.?
It's well, bilateral talks with South Korea, but yeah, and bilateral talks potentially with North... Well, I mean, there have been ongoing bilateral talks with South Korea, but yeah, there could be support in China for bilateral talks between North Korea and the United States.
And is there a specific thing China would... They want that to happen, one, because North Korea is becoming a problem for them as well, I assume. And
two... No, it has been, but...
Okay. And... But I assume it's kind of like they want to set some of the terms through North Korea, is what I'm guessing.
Well, they want to be able to set some of the terms. Like, I assume there will probably be an American withdrawal of some variety, even if they just move the troops that are currently stationed, like the one division or so that we have left, move them to Japan for the most part. There will probably be some amount of American troop withdrawal, because if North Korea unifies or ends the war and unifies, there's virtually no reason for American troops there other than to just have a strategic toehold in East Asia, on mainland Asia.
Yeah, so you think that North Korea wants unification?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, South Korea probably does.
Yeah. I mean, especially with their more liberal leader that they have now. And, I mean, they created a Bureau of Unification in the 2000s that is, you know, sidelined. But yeah, that's where they definitely want to go. A unified Korea would be an economic powerhouse. I think they're on like 5 or 6G cell phone communications. They've got cutting-edge technology, and North Korea's like just untapped natural resources.
Yeah, I mean, it would take some capital initially, which maybe would pay off really quickly, I think is what you're arguing, but it would take capital initially to just, like, bring up, you know, like, think about all the money you'd have to spend on, like, an electrical grid in North Korea.
Yeah, but think about the crazy amount of economic growth that would provide for South Korea trying to build
it. True. A lot of jobs, and, yeah, that's a good point, a lot of contracts. Interesting.
But I think North Korea, Kim Jong-un definitely, I mean, I've been saying it since he was brought in, but he definitely wants to end the Kim family regime and unify North Korea with South Korea. But he had to achieve that technological benchmark of creating a nuclear weapon, small enough to put on a missile, and creating an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of, you know, attacking the United States. But they had to do it internally
leverage.
Not necessarily leverage, but just, I mean, this is all domestic policy. All foreign policy is done for domestic purposes, and this is no exception, because he recognizes that he has been backed into a corner, but he's been backed into a corner by their juche, you know, their self-reliance ideology that the Kim family has instilled. Because if he did rapprochement with the United States without completing those benchmarks, he probably would have gotten shot by the regime. You know, the other people in the regime, because it's like, oh, you just surrendered. And it's like, no, we succeeded, and now we're negotiating.
Yeah. Is that part of the reason he got rid of some of the, I assume, hardliners?
I assume.
You know, when that... when taking out those other... what were those, like, generals, or just...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
His brother-in-law,
like,
or...
what, 3-4 years uncle? Ago?
Mm-hmm.
Ruthlessly,
too, like, with anti-aircraft gun.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus,
but
dude.
When that happened, it was kind of portrayed in the U.S. media as almost like him being more hardline than them.
And in a way, he was. He needs to ensure total personal control over the situation, because if all those guys are like, this is bullshit, we can't go along with this, and the whole situation just could go sideways quickly.
But it wasn't to consolidate North Korea's solitary status long run, is what you're saying.
No, absolutely not.
Okay, so North Korea wants unification, at least elements of North Korea. Elements of South Korea wants unification. The U.S. and China, you're saying, theoretically, at this point, might want... What?
Yeah. Both sides are like, because, you know, we want troops in South Korea. China doesn't want troops against their border, so this whole North Korean war is kind of an outside problem at this point for the Koreans.
Okay.
And so he had to go to Beijing on a 37-mile-an-hour train.
That's super slow for China, right?
That's super slow for any train. I mean, even here in the United States, they go like 70 miles an hour once they're outside of the cities.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I don't know. I think I got a good grasp on it. Yeah. I feel that there's elements, though, in the United States, at least, and maybe in China, but I don't know much about that, that would want unification, but with terms beneficial to them. I mean, it almost seems like there's maybe going to be two different conversations happening, one between North and South Korea, and one between, or maybe even three, one between China and the U.S., and then one between almost like those two talks.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how, like, logistically it would go, but, those seem to be the main two, or main three kind of separate things that have to at some point gel.
I'm not optimistic about having war hawks on our side either conducting these negotiations.
Yeah. I mean, if you think this was a long-term plan for Kim, do you think he was troubled by the election of Trump?
Had to be, right?
Yeah.
It's like impeding like the one avenue. Like if Hillary Clinton, I mean, she would have taken a similarly hard line against North Korea, probably even harder in some respects. But she probably would have been willing to negotiate. I mean...
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, because on one hand, she blasted Obama in 2008 when he said that he would sit down and talk even with the Iranian Ayatollah.
Yeah, because I almost wonder though if that's a difference between, like, the Clintons in general seem like the type that separate. This is, I think, why. Not to get into 2016 too much, but it seems like a problem with the Clintons, and something that people realize is that there's a difference between what they do in public and what they do in private. And I'm not even talking about massive criminal corruption. I'm just talking about, they put on a public face all of the time, and I don't think they live up to that public face in private, and maybe sometimes for the better. So what I'm saying is, she might have some sort of, she thinks publicly you're not supposed to negotiate with the bad guy, but maybe in private, I almost find it hard to believe that Secretary of State wouldn't have wanted there to be any talks.
Yeah, she's the biggest arms salesman in the history of the United States.
Really? Okay.
Well, I mean, this is another segment, perhaps, but we can look into how monumental, like, especially in the first term, Obama's arms sales were to, like, all sorts of, you know, the highlights of Transparency International and Amnesty.
Yeah. All right.
So, yeah, it's tough to ferret out what our American foreign policy would have been, but right now it is kind of a brick wall for any potential developments in North Korea or in the Korean Peninsula.
Well, I mean, back to Hillary, though. I mean, I don't know that... I find it hard to believe that she would have wanted to have a shooting war with North Korea.
No, I mean,
that's... seems highly, highly unlikely kind of, to me.
Yeah, it's not sensible, but she probably would have controlled it in such a way as to drive all of the political capital to be gained out of the situation.
Yes, which... And this might be something Trump actually realizes, too, but if you can be the president... See, like, Trump talks... Maybe he doesn't realize it, actually, but he talks a lot about, or at least you hear people who, like, know what they say in the White House, and, you know, talking about being the president that de-escalates the nuclear program of North Korea.
Sure.
But...
Except nobody takes... Reagan never took credit for South Africa, but, well, that's another issue.
But the kind of bigger get would be a peaceful unification, reunification, especially if that involved.
I mean, yeah.
I think it would be getting rid of the nukes, I think.
Well, yeah, I'm kidding. I don't... It's kind of... It's just kind of a... It paints a target on your head to have any kind of nuclear weapons anymore. That's why the South Africans were so eager to give them up.
Yeah, I mean, Pakistan.
And India.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the target was worth having that as leverage against the other one. Once one... Who had it first? Was it it was Pakistan, right?
I think so. Memory serves, but India was, like, right behind him.
Yeah.
Or vice versa.
I'm sure they had spies going back and forth up to, you know, similar to the U.S. and Russia back in the 50s. Okay. Oh, well, that was a... I enjoyed that. I find the North Korea thing really confusing, to be honest. And I feel like there is never a mature conversation about it, so I'm glad.
No, I'm hopeful for... If it were based on the actors on the ground, I would be hopeful, but when you include, like, other sides, it becomes much more complicated, you know?
Yeah. I was making fun of you before for this segment, calling it a fantasy segment. So, you have some ideas on what a progressive foreign policy... For America? Or just in general, progressive foreign policy?
Well, for the United States. Well, because right now, like, even in 2016, the foreign policy on offer was hard or somehow even harder. And, you know, we've gotten somehow even harder, so it's time to talk about, you know, what a progressive candidate might want to talk about in 2018 and 2020.
Yeah, one thing you don't hear in the past from... I'm not even saying we've had a viable, like, ultra-progressive foreign policy candidate, but from the bits you do hear, it's rarely very specific. Like, two that spring to mind are Bernie, which he was constantly talked about for being weak on foreign policy, which I don't know if he was, quote, weak, but he wasn't very detailed.
Yeah.
And Ron Paul, who wasn't a super relevant candidate. But even he was just like, we shouldn't be involved anywhere in the world ever. It's like, that's a... Maybe, but it's a really dramatic... I mean, I voted for him, so...
Yeah.
I obviously liked it, but...
I mean, really he articulated closer to this foreign policy than even Bernie Sanders has.
Yeah.
Or this kind of train of thought. Like, we thankfully have Mark Pocan as our representative, and I got a crappy form letter back from him when I called his office asking about foreign policy, but, you know, he's notionally, like, the most progressive foreign policy guy in Congress, and even he's, like, short on details, because once you start talking about foreign policy, especially in the United States, it very quickly gets towards that third rail, which I'm not even sure we should mention on this podcast, but we have already before. So yeah, the national security state.
It's interesting you bring up that like a congressman didn't seem to have a lot to say on it. I was just listening to some interview with it's kind of a topic that is sort of near and dear to you in a way you don't like, I'm sure. But is that how a lot of Democrats vote for a hardline, hawkish, conservative foreign policy. And in the interview, it was posited that most, not just Democrats, but even Republicans, but most congressmen and senators don't really know or care much about foreign policy. And so right, they just kind of do what the executive wants. And we've definitely been seeing that since 9/11, at least.
Right.
If not longer.
Well, because in our American, you know, body politic, the executive notionally has total control over foreign policy. Like, there's the Logan Act, there's longstanding Supreme Court precedent that Congress and other private individuals aren't supposed to interfere with American foreign policy, but at this point, I mean, what are we supposed to do?
Well, and clearly, if Congress wants to get together, they can assert themselves in some ways.
Well, I mean, they tried. Well, Bernie and who is that? Warner and Fox. They tried recently on that Yemen bill to make the executive get specific authorization for our involvement there, but that fell flat on its face. They're going to keep waving around that 2001 authorization for the use of military force until it's probably threadbare and just like an inch of paper and a kind of stapled to a flagpole.
Yeah, I think when Congress threw away the right of theirs to declare war and handed that over to the executive, they lost a lot of their bargaining ground with foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, in a practical sense, I do understand it. I mean, if the executive is control of pretty much everything, but except for whether or not we actually declare war and approving treaties, by the way, then it's like it's hard for them to constantly have enough bark if they don't necessarily have a bite to back it up. I mean, in the end, I still think the Congress should assert themselves with treaties and declarations of war, but...
And, like, maybe withholding checks.
Yeah, the purse, power of the purse, yeah, definitely.
But, you know, because a lot of our foreign policy, especially now that the State Department has been denuded and defunded, that all of our foreign policy is coming out of the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, right?
It's so scary.
So there's a few things that we could do to, you know, make America more progressive in its foreign policy, but a lot of it will mean some very, very big changes.
Okay.
Like I heard mentioned earlier, maybe in the last week or so, that we need an off-ramp from the empire. And we absolutely do. Like, we need to step back from being a giant global military power because it's destroying us, it's destroying those other countries, and it's literally destroying the planet.
I think especially because kind of, obviously, the United States post-World War II and I, pushing for, like, you know, the UN and these global orders as a way to kind of, you know, obviously there was the kind of unsaid, it's a way for us to assert our power, obviously. But I think the explicit reasons, which is to maintain peace and security and to kind of bring up the rest of the world, I think it was some truth to that, and on some level it's paying off.
Sure, but now we've come full circle, and now we have a president who openly hates these multilateral organizations.
Well, and I think that there has to be a way, and we probably should have already been doing this, particularly after the Cold War in the 90s. You know, the U.S. sort of asserted itself more after the Cold War, and I think maybe that was the time to be like, hey, we're still here, we are still a military power if need be,
Right.
But we're going to pull back a bit.
Well, even then, we probably could have gone, you know, more fully fleshed out some of the United Nations faculties, like perhaps some standing military force for the Security Council, so that, mm-hmm. you know, when things like happened in Rwanda and Somalia, you would have, like, somebody able to deploy, like, almost immediately to reinforce peacekeepers on the ground or start a new peacekeeping effort.
Yeah, that would have been...
And to respond to, like, international emergencies instead of, you know, just sitting on thumbs and watching the situation play out from your 15-person table.
Yeah. All right, so off-ramp from Empire. Is there any other way you see that?
Well, one thing that we would have to do as part of that is accede to the International Criminal Court, the Treaty of Rome.
Okay.
And, of course, the United States military is dead set against that, because if we did, we would have had a lot... They would have had a lot of indictments after the invasion of Iraq.
Yep. Let's add that to the 10,492 reasons why that was a bad war.
Yeah. Among the reasons. So, you know, there's other things that we can do to actually improve the United States. Like, we could improve international or institutional cooperation, like have the FBI work not necessarily closely, but in just maybe just work with them at all with, like, the ministry or this, like, the Russian FSB, their internal law enforcement, the Chinese law enforcement, Interpol, places like that. Not necessarily in a military way, but, you know, in to accede to evidentiary statutes. Like, if we can get information, like, it's complicated, but
okay,
yeah.
So, but
there are things we can
to,
do.
To bring cases in the international court.
Right, and to improve institutional knowledge, like, maybe they know something we don't. Like, Europe seems to have a little bit better handle on money laundering. Perhaps we could use that in our own court. Or our own law enforcement circles.
Okay, yeah.
But, you know, closing ourselves off with this, you know, America first foreign policy is, as I said, just going to hurt us and literally destroy the world.
Yeah, and so, just to end the off-ramp from Empire thing. Well, unless you had...
I mean, one part of that, we would have to give up the National the Security Council. We would have to give up our first among others imperial status.
See, I think the only way that works, though, is if everyone gives up the veto power.
I think everybody should.
Yeah. No, I'd agree with that. I think that's only been problematic. I think that's completely held back the UN, and it's led to people like Trump being able to say how weak the UN is, or how unnecessary, or whatever he fucking says.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that veto power is just really... So, I mean, what was the idea? Exactly behind the veto. Is it just like a reward for being an ally after World War II, or was it a specific...
Well, we gave it to the Russians, too, so even when they weren't necessarily our friends, it was a way... What happened with the League of Nations is that the United States pulled out because we, I guess, couldn't have our total say over it.
Okay.
And so, you know, this was Eleanor Roosevelt's way of keeping the United States and China and Russia at the table.
Oh, to make sure the big boys were invested.
Right.
Oh. That's interesting. It was short-sighted, but interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Probably short-sighted.
Yeah, all I was going to say, though, is that I think you properly delineated the difference between pulling away from empire-making and America first. Which has an isolationist sort of feel to it. But
sure,
you're not necessarily saying that. I just think it's important to...
Yeah, I don't want isolationism. That's not in anybody's interest. We're a country of immigrants that there would be nothing here if nobody... If we closed ourselves off, we would just be depreciating our own educational and moral capital.
Yeah. Hmm. So how else would you see progressive foreign policy?
Well, if we acceded to the International Criminal Court and did perhaps a few other things with military spending, we would be able to righteously condemn atrocities like in Myanmar and Israel that we at least in some respect are responsible for, or have, you know, not necessarily denounced. Like, as of this recording, only Bernie Sanders, I think, has gone on national TV and said what the Israelis did in response to the incidents on the Gaza border were wrong.
Yeah, I don't know that that would, your first part would lead to the second one in terms of Israel.
Well, it was just the most, yeah, the easiest example.
Just, Israel's a whole other show type thing.
Well, yeah, but again, if the Security Council wasn't there, Israel would necessarily have to change its policy.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay. It's being, because it has a vetoing member behind it, us, mm-hmm. It can, okay, yeah, that's a good point.
Do whatever it wants.
Yeah. Can the General Assembly vote?
The General Assembly can override the Security Council, but it would require some extraordinary measures that obviously I don't think have ever been done, except in a few cases which are directly applied to, or directly applicable to Israel.
Oh.
Because I think one time there was a condemnation resolution that got overturned by the General Assembly, like, no, this is wrong, if memory serves. I don't have the facts in front of me, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'd have to give up our imperial privilege. I mean, we've, even from a domestic point of view, like, having a purely military foreign policy is terrible because the return on investment for military spending is less than, you know, 1-to-1 ratio. Like, we don't get all of the money back that we spend into defense spending like we do with education and infrastructure, where it's multiplied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know,
we're starving ourselves.
What was that?
We're starving ourselves in a very aggregate macroeconomic way through our imperial military.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's been
pretty well established.
Yeah, and one of the, you know, I think there, you can obviously make an argument for benefits to protecting. It's not necessarily one that appeals to me that much, but you can make towards protecting, you know, U.S. investments and interests and allies and through.
Sure, I'm not saying withdraw from NATO, but we can perhaps withdraw from maybe 100 or so of the 160 some countries that we have military bases in.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that it's easy to point out the benefits for you know, the hawkish types, but it's harder for them to say that if they acknowledge the costs, and just really practical, just money costs to all right. of this that, as you're saying, could have been spent.
Right. I'm not a dove, and having served in the military, I'm not a peacenik, but there are better ways of defending the country.
Yeah, and you know, and picture just how much less economic anxiety the average person would have if, you know, we wouldn't have been spending, what, half of our budget?
Yeah, can you imagine what would happen if all of a sudden we had $760 billion to just spend domestically? It's like, okay, well, I guess free college and healthcare, and we're not even through the first $100 billion. I guess everybody gets roads again? Well, you people in Iowa that went back to gravel, well, back to asphalt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe we could build a huge new commuter, intermodal transportation system where people wouldn't have to have their own cars so much. But that's just a pipe dream, I guess.
If there was a way for people from rural areas to more effectively travel to cities, it's hard because, man, we're getting really off topic because it's getting into domestic policy, but it is all connected. But for, you know, because no one wants to make that investment to get this town of 600 people to be able to get to the town of 200,000. That's an hour away, because, you know, there's so many. And but if there's just some way to get those people, I just think that kind of rural resentment that we see a lot here in Wisconsin, and I think you see a lot of places,
mm-hmm.
would just be diminished. Like, if they could quickly and easily, for jobs and for just more commercial uses, get to cities and see the benefits.
I mean, if I wanted to take a bus to get from where I am to where you are and record the podcast live, it would take me 5 hours of travel at a minimum.
Yeah. But even take the car. I mean, just to drive, yeah, it's an hour drive, but you can't. I mean, some people do, but most people don't want to drive an hour back and forth to a job.
No.
And especially when you talk about northern states when you have inclement weather for half the year.
I mean, we've kind of really gotten off topic, but that kind of development would be really good for basically any business to be able to draw from a wider group of customers and potential employees.
Yeah. Well, hey, to bring it back around, though, is that, like you were saying, in the beginning of the segment, how a lot of, in general, legislators, but particularly progressive ones, don't focus on foreign policy. It is so important to focus on foreign policy if you have a domestic priority.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, they are one and the same. They really are. And
right. If we wanted to have better, renewable energy technology, why wouldn't we just develop it and sell it to the rest of the world? Find more customers than... sorry. That's something I'm passionate about. But yeah, we could... Yeah. Because there's 6 some odd billion people other than the United States that might be interested in the technology and culture that we develop? Are interested already, so...
Every time we bring up something this segment, I just think back to, man, if W would not have been president.
Right. I think that's when we went to the darkest timeline.
There are definitely mistakes made, you know.
In Clinton's era.
And previously. I'm sure we could point to almost any administration in the 20th century and find some sort of major foreign policy mistake. But, man, at that time with technology developing... With, you know, and even Clinton made some mistakes, but he did do less military spending.
Mm-hmm. He was trying to draw down the military and refocus it to, peacekeeping operations.
Trying to balance the budget and, you know, I think set us on a good course. And maybe he didn't do enough, it's debatable, but it was on a good course.
Yeah,
and for, man, just Bush to come at that time, 9/11 happening when it did, just fucked us over, man. It just really mm-hmm. fucked us over. And his response to it, when you were talking about, better ways to make us safer without, you know, dropping bombs and sending out armies. I mean, it's really almost laughable, if it wasn't so serious, how stupid it is to send an army overseas in response to 9/11.
Yeah, that was purely a law. That should have been purely the FBI in a law enforcement matter.
It's I mean, to protect against some dudes getting on a plane and flying it into a building, you're sending an army a half a world away?
To go find their training camp, I guess?
I mean, you could make a good argument, I guess, for, say, you know, consolidating departments into Homeland Security. I mean, even though there's definitely elements of bullshit there. But at least I get that as a way to solve it. But spending how many... Trillions? Probably trillions of dollars.
Yeah, trillions.
On these two wars. Because
we put all those. Seven now, but.
Even to give them the best benefit of the doubt, which is that they were really worried about the security of Americans and they took it seriously, then they are just beyond inept. And just so ignorant of their actions and repercussions. It's just mind-boggling. And I think it set in some ways, it had a what's that called? Like a not a momentum, but the force from spin, inertia. There's like such an inertia that I think the Obama administration, again, just giving them the best of intentions, which may not be true, I just think they couldn't break away from.
Hmm.
I mean, can someone now? So let's say, okay, let's end on not necessarily a prediction, but like a fantasy of the future. So
back to fantasy, huh?
Trump runs against, let's say, someone of the more progressive bent.
Even Bernie.
In 2020. Could be Bernie, could be someone like that. What should they campaign on, and what is... not keeping it too fantastical, let's try and be, I guess, a little realistic. What would be realistic things that they could do initially? I mean, all of these things you said, would those be politically reasonable?
I mean, once you're president, I don't know why you would ever, like... I mean, if I were president, I would just go for broke like Trump is and wait until they impeach me. But, of course, I would be doing it in a far more beneficial way, I think.
It's interesting. Yeah, I see what you're saying, though. Especially
like, and this, a lot of this just amounts to, like, executive decisions of, like, hey, let's not send troops over there. Let's fund the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess that's you'd have to work with Congress on that, but, you know, there's just things you can do. And a lot of the institutional cooperation could also be mandated by the executive or the president in whatever capacity.
Okay. What would be... So, I mean, it's kind of easy to imagine things you don't do that maybe past presidents did do.
Mm-hmm.
What about something...
And then I would, as you know, the other side of that you're trying to lead me towards is that we would support Chapter 5 and Chapter 7 United Nations peacekeeping operations abroad.
Okay.
Like, put our foreign military endeavors entirely under some kind of international oversight and auspices. Like, things that we can all agree to. Like, hey, let's send troops to perhaps Myanmar or those kind of places.
Do you think that would be... Because, I mean... American politics is tricky. That might be a tough sell. I could picture being a tough sell.
The tough sell there is that peacekeeping... Because the spin that you always hear is peacekeeping is bad for troops. But that is entirely not the case.
Yeah.
Because, think about it. Peacekeeping is just war. Without getting shot at, you're still doing all of the same things. Like, you're patrolling, you're attempting to interact with the local population, you're interdicting potential violence, but you're not getting shot at just for being there. Which allows for, you know, more better educational outcomes among the soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And far less PTSD.
I don't know, it just feels like...
Dead people don't buy things, you assholes, come on!
Yeah, well, alright, we should leave it there. Because actually in the next segment we'll talk a little bit about American foreign policy. And how it's, Well, okay, we'll see you in the next segment. Alright, today we have a grown-up book report. The book is by Joshua Hammer. It's called The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. I bought it because I was at the bookstore, and as I do every time, I go look in the world history section and think, wow, these books are huge and academic, and I will not be able to read it all. And then I found this one that had badass in the name and looked exciting. So, it came out a couple years ago, I believe it was 2016.
And I'm just going to read the quote on the title from the Washington Post, because I think it's just... after reading the book, I'm like, yeah, no, that just pretty much sums it up. Part intellectual history, part geopolitical tract, and part out-and-out thriller. It's kind of like a little mixture of both. The beginning of the book is primarily a background of Timbuktu and its academic history, its cultural history. It goes through it being part of a couple different empires. There's some ups and downs with...
At one time, it was home to the richest man in history.
Oh, really? I didn't mention that. That's awesome. Is that the emperor that went to... They did talk about this emperor that was from the area and went on pilgrimage and stopped in Egypt and brought so much gold that it brought the... As gifts, that it brought the price of gold down in Egypt for like a decade.
Yeah, and in Mecca too.
Oh yeah,
he went on the Hajj pilgrimage and destroyed the price of gold. Probably part of the reason early America used silver.
That's crazy. And so, anyway, the big takeaway from that beginning kind of background history is that, first of all, not that many people necessarily think this today, but not that long ago, there was a narrative that Africa did not have a rich literary tradition. And Timbuktu, as people have learned more and more about it in the West, has a really rich academic and literary history, scholarly tradition. And they are primarily, the records of them are these manuscripts. Oh, actually, the subtitle of the book is "And the Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts." And so, these manuscripts were primarily held by families handed down over generations in private hands. And they date as far back as, I think it was the 14th century, 15th or 14th century, up till mid-19th century. And they are some of the best examples of the Islamic scholarly tradition. So a lot of them are translations of the Quran, but a lot of them are maps of the stars. They're about mathematics. The main character in the book, which I'll get to, some of his favorite manuscripts were about conflict resolution. There's medical ones. All types.
Is this the same kind of stuff that was in the libraries in Baghdad? Or is it just shared with the libraries in Timbuktu? It sounds like the same kind of body of information.
Probably. I don't know exactly what was in the libraries of Baghdad, but I did get the impression that these were manuscripts that were...
copied.
Yeah, and Timbuktu became kind of the main intellectual hub of Islam in Western North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of gives you the impression in the beginning that it might have even been superior in terms of academics to Cairo, which would have been in Africa the main just population center.
Sure.
Really fascinating history. I certainly learned a lot. I mean, Timbuktu is just, I knew it was kind of had like a university thing going on, but I didn't really know any details about it. So anyway, these manuscripts are handed down over the years, and they get into this main character. His name is Abdel Kader Haidara. And he was given his, even though he comes from like many, many, many brothers and sisters, he was the youngest, I believe, or one of the youngest. Because, you know, his father had multiple wives. And his dad not only had a collection that dated back, but
was also into getting more manuscripts, and so he collected these. And he had a big, he had like something like 5,000, maybe even more, just thousands and thousands of these.
Jesus.
And so when his dad was about to die, they said that he, or maybe it was just in the will, but at 17 he was given the collection when his father died. And he was like, whoa, me? But he was kind of like the nerdy kid, so I think that's why they gave it to him. So, around this time, UNESCO, the UN agency, was attempting kind of independently to start a library there where they wanted to collect these. So they, because his father knew this guy who was running it, this guy running it talks Haidara into being someone who works for this library and goes around and collects these manuscripts, you know, buys them from people, locates them. You go to little villages all around the region, and this is in Mali, by the way, if people don't know where Timbuktu is. It's in the Saharan kind of southern Sahara, bordering on Nigeria. The Niger River is right, goes, Timbuktu is on the Niger River, the upper Niger, I guess. And anyway, so he goes around to all these villages, sometimes even by boat, because Timbuktu is not easily accessible, at least back in the 70s, or 80s, 70s and 80s, when he was first doing this. And anyway, so he puts together this huge collection, helps start this library. It's really cool. He eventually starts a library of his own manuscripts of his dad's. He gets funding from all over the world. A lot of it comes from Dubai and I think it was Saudi Arabia. Or sorry, Kuwait, I believe it was. And but then also from the West, from the Netherlands, from the United States. Like, it was like, I think the Ford Foundation was a major one. And he gets this money to start his library. They scan the documents. There's all types of cool information, and there's sort of some drama about how he starts it all. It's really exciting. Well, and by the way, and then a bunch of other libraries pop up. Like, it's not even that big of a city. And they have tons of these libraries, of these old, old manuscripts that have such precious knowledge and history. Well, then the book kind of takes a break and goes into the kind of little bit more geopolitical tract. So that was the intellectual history. Here's the geopolitical tract. And that pretty much starts with the bombing of Libya, of Gaddafi. There's also some in there about a little bit of the history, recent history of Algeria as well. And that sets off, what would you say, like dominoes falling across the region?
Probably the only actual application of domino theory.
Well, but it was more chaos, you know?
Yeah, it was
like an avalanche.
Cascading chaos.
Yeah. What happened is, you know, the main takeaway that I had from how what happened in Libya affected Mali, and it sounds like even other countries in the area, is that there wasn't follow-up on the part of America.
There was
You probably know more about that part than even me having just read this book, but...
Sure. But, you know, people took advantage of the chaos and they churned out Gaddafi's arms stores, which led to the Tuareg Rebellion.
Exactly. And so, all of a sudden there's tons of guns and rockets and everything being pushed around the region. Bombing Libya, taking out the government, but then there's, all these arms all over the region. And it causes trouble in Algeria. And this is all kind of like the Saharan parts of those countries, so the kind of what would you say, like the lawless areas, the ungoverned areas, because these are huge swaths of land.
Right. Yeah, it's just a lot of it is open desert, so it's tough to navigate.
And then, you know, then there'll be like mountains and canyons and caves and then just giant like 100-mile stretches of just desert and dunes and so many
nomadic tribes.
There's all these arms going through the area, and they end up with a major group that gets them, eventually dubs themselves, although there's a lot of name-changing going on. It's kind of funny, actually. They're just, like, constantly regrouping and having a new catchy name. Eventually ends up with a group called Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb.
Hmm. A-Q-I-M, yep.
Yeah, yep. And the three main characters in that are Abdelhamid Abu Zaid, who was kind of a religious zealot. I believe he's ethnically Arabic, but I'm not positive of that. And but he was very religious. Then there's Mokhtar. Oh, by the way, he was malnourished as a kid, so he's like super short. They constantly talk about him carrying like a heavy AK, you know, like big long thing, and it looked comical. And then there's Mokhtar Belmokhtar, who was a little less ideological. He was more of a cigarette runner across the Sahara, drugs, arms.
Wait, he's still out and about, isn't he? I've heard that name recently.
Yes, he's the one that is still out and about. The first guy, spoiler, gets killed at the end. Belmokhtar was rumored to be killed many times, but I don't think he was. But this guy is just very, like, power-hungry, kind of greedy, rebellious, not necessarily religious, even though he was supporting a group that was pushing Sharia law. But the impression everyone seems to have is that he's doing it for more selfish reasons. And then the last character is by far the most interesting to me, and that's Iyad Ag-Ghali. He was ethnically Tuareg. He had been a Tuareg. So the Tuaregs are like these nomadic peoples of the Saharan kind of Mali area, but I think they probably, since they're nomadic, go between a couple areas. And they have been wanting an independent state that they call Azawad, Azawad, in kind of northern Mali for decades. And they've been fighting little insurrections and rebellions. And he was a long time associated with those. He eventually, though, gets involved with the government. He actually had a government job, a government office. And he was kind of a go-between. He kept the Tuaregs, you know, from revolting, but, you know, kind of, I don't know exactly what the Tuaregs got out of it, but he was able to, he was considered a leader amongst them, and they listened to him. And then the last thing I'll say, this is kind of related to the cultural importance of Timbuktu, about this Ghali, is that in that area of northern Mali, and the Sahara, there apparently was this musical movement going on. It's kind of related to, like, blues. So there's some musician there, and he kind of died by the main plot of the story, but he was really influential. So a lot of these Tuaregs actually formed, like, blues bands. And they would have these...
What is that guy's name?
They would have these...
I know who you're talking about.
Okay, yeah. He's one of the ones I didn't write down, but he's in here somewhere. But they would have... and this Ghali was part of one of them. He was a poet. He wrote lyrics for one.
And so he's an MC.
So he... Yeah, I don't know if he sang, though, but he definitely... He wrote it. And they often would be about, you know, the glory of battle and, you know, stuff like that. And kind of... They're sort of rebellious, as any good music should be, I guess. But they would get, like, eventually they got Bono to one of these festivals. They'd get Led Zeppelin's Jimmy Page. He played at one, actually, with this this kind of this band that Ghali was associated with, although after he was associated with them. And there was this big music festival, and it seemed like, you know, bright days were ahead. And then the trouble happens in Libya. Arms get out there. You already were seeing a rise in Wahhabist influence in the area. And this kind of hardline form of Islam, which is very not the tradition of Timbuktu itself, necessarily.
No, they were really inclusive.
Yeah.
Multicultural.
So this main... the librarian Haidara, he really believed in like the good form of Islam. He believed in the well-read, open-minded, slightly secular form. And so this Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb forms an alliance with the Tuaregs because Iyad Ag-Ghali, the Tuareg, former musician, he starts becoming really religious. He actually got kicked out of Saudi Arabia at one point for being too, like...
extreme?
Yeah, like, Sharia everything type guy.
And the people with religious beliefs and a propensity for, like, beheading people in the streets found this guy to be too religious.
Wow. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And so he comes back, and he starts shunning music. He changes. He just flat-out changes. But he negotiates an alliance between the Tuaregs and the jihadis. And they start insurrection in northern Mali. And because of that jihadi Sharia disdain for any culture that isn't just, what, the Quranic verses, I guess?
Yeah, they are super austere about that. Like, no music, like, virtually no art. Yeah, and no tolerance for other peoples.
Yeah, like, they took the radio station over and just made them read Quranic verses all day. Like, worst radio station ever. I think we might have a couple of the Christian versions of that, though, around here. So anyway, they don't do it right away, but the librarians eventually, you know, they're like, oh shit, they're going to destroy these manuscripts.
Yeah, they absolutely are.
And it's the way, and this is, by the way, the out and out thriller part of the book. The jihadis don't seem focused on it. Like, a bunch of them were camped out in one of the libraries, or using it for their, you know, where their barracks almost. Mm-hmm. And they never searched the building for the manuscripts. And so the librarians, like, had most of them in a storage in the basement. And so, towards the end of the book, some of them come in and they're like, they go grab a couple of them and burn them. And this is the only ones that were lost, by the way. But they never just searched the whole building for the rest of them. Yeah, and the staff was like, you can kind of, like, picture if this is a movie, like, just, like, those, like, sidelong glances constantly, but they got away with it. But anyways, they were...
like, I don't want to tell you how to do your job, but maybe you might want to think about burning these.
Yeah.
You say you want to burn them.
There was a... she actually doesn't give her name in the book, which I find curious, but there's some lawyer from Washington State, from the Seattle area, who... she kind of has she's an international woman of mystery, is what I picked up. And she had a house in Mali, and she became very interested in these manuscripts. And when all this happened, she was communicating with this Haidara, and like, we have to get these out of here. We have to do it. And Haidara dragged his feet because he didn't want him leaving Timbuktu, both for kind of
personal and cultural reasons.
Yeah, but then also practical, because Timbuktu has a really good climate for preserving this stuff. It's dry.
Oh, there it is.
I mean, there's some problems with the dryness. It makes things brittle, but the mold. There's no mold there. But yeah, also just, you know, they've been there for centuries. They've been through other troubled times. And
right? It's not like they just invented war in Africa.
Yes, it's not a recent phenomenon. And even they've even survived a Sharia law upswing. In the mid-1800s, there was an someone instituted Sharia law. But that wasn't even as hardline as the recent Sharia law. So they kind of just hid those away, but they were never sought after by the people who were in charge. And so they most of it survived just fine, and it didn't take some epic operation to get them out. So cutting to the chase, that's what they did here. They had an epic operation. They went and bought, like, all of the metal and wooden crates within, like, miles of Timbuktu, like, towns over. They'd go, and they'd send different people, and they were all family members of people who owned manuscripts, because they could be trusted. And they did this while Timbuktu was occupied by jihadis. And they had, like, caravans of trucks. Eventually roads got cut off, so they had caravans of these of boats. And it was like, so this Haidara actually wasn't even in Timbuktu at this point. He got his family out to the capital, and he was on the phone constantly with organizing. He's like a general. He's better than a general. I mean, this is like improvising. He doesn't even have like a big institution, you know. It was funded in part by international organizations. So again, like the Ford Foundation, some other groups from Europe, and I think the Extraction was also funded by some groups in the Middle East. Really bringing people together, by the way. Like the West and the Middle East coming together to secretly fund this operation. And yeah. They extract like hundreds of thousands of these, store them around the capital in people's basements, and it went on for like months, and they got it all out. They didn't lose one manuscript in the process of getting them out.
My God, you couldn't even move a division without somebody losing their rifle.
Oh, dude, it's insane. Like they are constantly, So they had a few hundred thousand to do this, and a lot of that went towards bribes.
Of course.
So, like one time when they're in the boats, they go through this like marshy area that was. It reminds me of the Roine in that one part of Game of Thrones, where the pirates patrol. You know.
Yeah.
It's like an area like that. There's pirates on this river as it hits this marsh plain, and with like in this area of like tall reeds, so people can hide and stuff. And these guys capture it. They're like, what's this? And they're like, oh, we just have to get to the capital. And so they get the Haidara on the phone, and he's like, listen, we will pay you a handsome amount of money. And good on the pirates for trusting them. They let them go, and sure enough, someone showed up a few days later with a bunch of money for them. And they did this all over. They had the Mali governmental... The Mali military,
I think conducted a coup at some point during all this.
They did. They did conduct a coup at some point during all of this, and they were a hapless yet ornery group. No one respected them, yet they were constantly present, causing trouble for everyone. Because, like, all of their troops were poorly trained and disgruntled. And so... whenever there's something you didn't want them to do, you get this impression that someone is doing it in their group, in the military. And so they were, like, having all these roadblocks.
Having to bribe the people at the fucking checkpoint.
So they're constantly bribing the military. Even though, theoretically, they're on the same side, but that doesn't mean the individual troops aren't... Yeah.
Greedy assholes?
Yeah. So they get them all out. And then the kind of at the end goes a little bit back to the geopolitical part, and I think this is just because the author had these connections. It tells the story of how the insurrection was put down by the French, primarily. The French got fed up with things and came in there, and the book portrays it actually as an example of foreign intervention done right, because... they didn't necessarily stay that long.
Right, because, well, just like another good model intervention, the invasion of Kuwait, or the un-invasion of Kuwait, I don't know if you want to call it.
Yeah. yeah, short-lived.
Mm-hmm. Easy.
Yeah, there's... I mean, it didn't solve everything long-term.
Anything.
And but... I think there... the book has one passing line, like, some intellectuals in Mali see it as modern colonialism. And it's like, apparently most people in Mali didn't see that that way. But, you know, there's always going to be, I think, a little... If you know, if any other big country with giant guns comes into your country, there's going to be a segment of animosity, I think
it's, and some resentment is to be expected.
Especially when they used to be the colonial overlords. You know, like, how can you not feel a little like...
Man, I hate the French, but fuck those jihadis.
So, yeah, French come in. Help save the day. Everyone hates the Sharia people, at least in that area, especially in Timbuktu. And the manuscripts were preserved. They'll come back. The kind of tragic undertone of the book, though, is that there seems to be... there's no guarantee it won't happen again. Unfortunately.
Right. That's entropy for you.
Yeah. But yeah, highly, highly recommend the book. It was a fun read. Quick read. Lots of info in there, though. And yeah, it has a little bit of a few kind of different sorts of books to keep you engaged. Yeah, that's my grown-up book report. You were just asking me about the Brewers.
They right, so the Brewers lost opening day. Does that mean there's four more years of Walker?
Well, yeah, I don't know. They lost to the Cardinals, who their governor's in more trouble than ours will ever be. he's a nasty son of a bitch down there. That guy's bad. Not even like public corruption bad. I mean, maybe, but just like
blackmailing somebody with revenge porn. Jesus Christ, yeah, dude. Just that's the baseline.
And he didn't even step down, right?
Didn't he? I thought he got arrested. Well, that's another segment.
Yeah, we'll have to re-up research on him. I thought he was being defiant, him and his wife. Which, anyway. The Brewers lost opening day. They play to... I don't think they're playing yet today. But they are... they won. They swept the San Diego Padres in the opening series of the year.
Huh. So does it look good this year so far, or how are we going to...
Yeah, they look great. Okay. That being said...
they always look great at the start.
Well, and their division is tough, so it won't be an easy road by any means. Even if they are a good team, they are just going to be playing other good teams a lot. What was I going to ask about? Where's my notes here? Boop, boop, boop. You were going to say something about Netanyahu?
About Gaza, specifically, I think.
Oh, yeah, you kind of brought that up.
Oh, no. The Netanyahu thing was the deportation thing. So this past Monday, like, on April Fool's, like, all of the African, primarily Eritrean refugees had to... leave Israel, and at the last minute it was announced that there was a deal with the UN whereby instead of getting deported to Uganda or Rwanda, they would get deported to Western countries. And apparently that deal has already fallen apart from right-wing pressure in Israel. Like, apparently the West is too good for the poor people they want to get rid of. And that's, like, the nicest way that I can say it, or describe it.
Yeah, we never really brought up on the show all of his corruption dealings there.
Man, that guy is... He's got, like, what, three different corruption inquiries right now that the Israeli police are working on?
Yeah, it seems really analogous to Trump, where their law enforcement is investigating him... But he's being protected by a conservative majority in the legislature.
Like a bare conservative majority. That guy's, even since he came back into power, has been kind of hanging on by a thread in coalition with like ultra-right conservative parties in the Knesset. But yeah, I would point out the one difference is that Trump never served, but Netanyahu was like a special forces officer. He was involved in that raid in 72 in Uganda to kill those people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, whenever you try and compare Trump to other leaders, prominent figures, there's always the caveat of he's a unique blend, you know.
Of incompetent and successful.
Yeah, and, like, ostentatious and just the worst. Just, I don't know.
The worst, yeah.
Just throw in a dash of the worst.
Dash of feces for flavor.
Because, yeah, you can compare him, say, you know, like, there's easy comparisons to, say, Putin or, you know, people to Kim Jong-un or, you know.
But again, accomplished people.
Sometimes, you know, over the past couple of years, I'd be reading some whatever, some story about, doesn't even have to be politics or, yeah, but, you know, someone just seems like super vain. And you're like, oh, man, that seems Trumpian to me. But it's just no one ever quite fits it completely. He's a unique blend.
Hopefully once in a lifetime or once even in history.
Berlusconi's kind of like him.
Yeah, but again, more successful.
Business-wise, you mean?
Yeah, Berlusconi owns like almost all the Italian media, right? Or at least a significant portion of it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what Trump wanted to do. If in a different timeline where Trump lost the election, he was going to start his own TV network.
You know, Trump is probably really regretting
running for office. Hopefully,
well, yeah. I was going to say just not. It's like he's, you know, he sounds so obsessed with TV. He probably just wishes he would have gotten in on like Fox News 30 years ago, like as an investor or something, instead of just investing through thousands and thousands of hours of his time. I wonder if he is invested. Is he tied in, or does he just use it for the propaganda?
No, I mean, he's got... that guy doesn't do anything without benefiting himself, so I'm sure he's invested in some respect.
He's constantly tweeting, retweeting Fox and Friends and shit.
Well, they're the only people who agree with him, so...
Yeah, it's the most powerful show in America.
Any other clue? Let's see, what else is going on this week?
Well, we should say Shulkin got
fired. Oh, right. He got fired? Not resigned, apparently, but no, he left anyway.
He didn't want to resign, supposedly. I think he wrote an op-ed, slightly defiantly. I don't think it, like, revealed.
You know, trying to wrap himself in that cloak of the resistance to save his own
skin.
A little bit.
Yeah, I don't think he, like, totally tried to throw Trump under the bus, but... Yeah, he was fired. He didn't seem terribly happy about it. And they nominated the doctor, the Peter White Jackson. House doctor.
Mm-hmm. The guy who said Trump was just 1 pound under medically obese.
Yeah, it's funny, I listened to the Pod Save America, and they all worked in the White House, and that guy was the doctor at the time. So they're really conflicted, where they're like, he seemed really great, he's a nice guy, he was really great, but... Man, the way he talked about Trump is weird.
Strangely glowing.
Yeah, I just... And they're showing clips of it on Oliver's show this past weekend. And it's just, you know, it's fresh in my mind. But, man, some of the things he said, just...
He has great genes. What?
Yeah.
Dude. What is your... How do you have any kind of... Even a doctor doesn't have any real... information to make that.
You didn't do a genetic test. Like, what doctor would say that? Yeah. Or he said, what did he say? Something like he could live to 200 or something?
Yeah. I mean, maybe if he cut out the KFC, but.
Well, what do we know? He lives to 200. He can't. Like, what does that even mean to say that? Like, that's just the only person that wants that. That was the audience of one phenomenon.
Yeah,
he was giving a press conference not for the general public, but before the president. Why? I don't know. Why?
I mean, Sarah Huckabee Sanders does it every day, so...
Yeah, but What does the doctor have to... I mean, why is he so protective of his job?
He seemingly got Secretary of VA out of it, so can't say he was wrong, huh?
Yeah, do you think he even wants that? I guess he does if he accepted it, but he's active military, so he might have felt like he couldn't turn it down.
Wow, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, because, yeah, he's a one-star flag officer, so he couldn't exactly disobey a lawful order.
I mean, that's what they say about, we're saying about...
McMaster.
McMaster.
It's interesting that, man, I love how the military bureaucracy is impeding Trump's plans slightly, because, you know, McMaster, being a military officer, can't just get up and leave and go to some other post. It's fascinating.
Wait, why? What is that? What do you mean?
Because, yes, he's, you know, by law, he's in his position, so they have to go through the bureaucratic process of finding another place for him, you know, because he's a flag officer. So he has to have a slot, basically, and it's one of the commands. But, you know, until he has that, he can't really be moved, because they can't just put him off on leave and put him into the bureaucratic ether.
But they could have Bolton also, right? Like, there could be...
And then you kind of get into, like, you know, that seating org chart, because it's like, is McMaster on leave? Because he's still in the position, so... By statute, or, you know, I guess whatever statute governs those executive orders might have some say into, like, you know, you can't have an acting person when there's already... Yeah. It's complicated. Because McMaster isn't unable to do his job physically, so...
Hey, Was Kelly's retired, right?
He retired in 2013, if memory serves.
Oh, I didn't realize he was out that long. Okay.
Yeah, he did it and then joined the board of Theranos immediately.
No, that was Mattis.
Oh, you're right, Mattis. You're right. I keep getting these generals mixed up.
But
all white men look alike to me.
But I think Kelly...
Yeah, Kelly was retired before he took on the Homeland Security job.
The internet failed me. He retired. He was succeeded in that post in January 2016. So, pretty recent. At least that's when he was no longer in the head of Southern Command. Doesn't say when he actually.
I think he retired from that position.
Yeah. Seems like that would be the case.
So it's been a few years.
Yeah, but I mean, it was less than a year before he became DHS. I mean, he probably...
Yeah, I suppose.
He probably just got over chilling out for, you know, like relaxing.
I bet that guy doesn't have any measure of chill.
What, you say Marine generals can't chillax?
No, I'm sure some can, but nah, some of them... I guess that's why they're successful military officers, but some people are just... always active, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, you're right. He does... I mean, he doesn't look like someone that... Sorry, these pictures on Wikipedia are, like, completely confirmed. It's like, no way this guy, like, lounges on a beach or...
Yeah, I can't picture this guy on a beach.
Even fucking...
I love the faraway look in his main picture on Wikipedia.
Yeah, yeah. Or even, like, drinking a beer and, like, watching a game. I mean, honestly...
Oh, his second picture from the U.S. Southern Command is him acting like he's smiling.
Yeah, it's like, I'm trying to act affable in front of Congress. And then the one right below
is him, like,
grimacing at reporters.
See, I have concern. This is my concern feel.
Oh, boy. Kelly. Wow. When's he out? He's got to be out soon, right?
I mean, they've been talking about him being out since you came in, so...
Yeah, I don't... Like, he's... I don't know.
I mean, I've heard it's been getting louder. The leaks, I guess, are getting louder, and that Trump doesn't seem to be going along with his particular stringent form of discipline. For whatever that's worth.
Yeah, it seems like Kelly is... Maybe what's keeping him there is that he's actually kind of inept, because or he agrees with all these staff changes.
Well, he agrees with Trump, I think that's pretty clear.
I think he agrees with Trump more than what was let on, yeah, originally.
Yeah. I mean, he had to have, right? He was willing to be Secretary of Homeland Security. And under a guy who was like, let's close the border and deport all the foreigners.
Yeah, but all these fucking, like, TV never-Trumpers and... Not necessarily all never-Trumpers, but... Like those, you know, those kind of like, I don't like Trump, but I'm a Republican, those fucking people. They had this narrative that he was one of the, you know, adults in the room.
That just means he knows how to carry out those extreme policies.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Like it's not like some cartoonish executive order that Trump thought up and Stephen Miller typed up while he was tethered on hooks in the other room.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, he didn't seem to be really much of a check on Trump. If for no other reason than, hey, don't do this because it'll get bad headlines, but not so much, don't do this because it's bad.
Right.
Man, that's like, it's a scary thought, though. Like, and fuck however that narrative got put out.
Oh, yeah, and I love this quote. Like, you don't mind if I read this to you from Kelly's Wikipedia. In a 2014 speech regarding the war on terror, Kelly said, quote, if you think this war against our way of life is over because some of the self-appointed opinion makers and chattering class grow, quote, war-weary, unquote, because they want to be out of Iraq or Afghanistan, you are mistaken. This enemy is dedicated to our destruction. He will fight us for generations, and the conflict will move through various phases as it has since 9/11, unquote.
So that was a Steve Bannon quote, or...?
No, that's John Kelly.
No, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Way of life. Come on, man.
Yeah, that whole, like, East... it's not even necessarily East-West, but this whole, like, clash of civilizations. Like, that's, you know, tying it back to our grown-up book report this week.
And our progressive foreign policy.
There's a good... It's ridiculous to think that the whole Muslim world wants to be in a fight with us. And not with the crazy people who rolled into their town with AKs and trucks and made them put shit on their head and stop dancing like fucking Footloose or something.
Right, and turn that music off.
Yeah, like they... And so, but if you have that mentality, like it's us versus Islam, us versus Muslims,
right?
Us versus
all you see are
the
males.
Middle East as a whole, then you're going to not only propel the recruitment of the extremists, but you're going to just, you know, not everything's two sided, but if one side is insisting something's two sided. Then
it becomes.
Everyone else, yeah, starts, even if they're not allying, they start, a potential ally is turned into an enemy that way. And it's so stupid, man.
Yeah, there's a lot of stupidity behind the whole formulation of the war on terror, to my mind.
You know, I listened to something.
Well, go maybe ahead. Not stupidity, but. It's founded off, like you said, a stupid premise and then is carried out stupidly, but I guess in some respect it is kind of dangerous and brilliant what Cheney and Addington thought up.
Yeah.
A war without end.
Yeah, I was listening to something recently where they were talking about how they're like, they're bitching about Trump, and they were like, Trump doesn't even do what W did with, you know, like W would. Pay lip service and say we're not at war with Islam and we're, you know, which maybe didn't even really have a practical difference, though it would be nice for people to say it more, but, you know, actions speak louder than words. But I don't know, I mean, maybe there is like a there is one of those kind of sick Trump is better, at least because he's honest type things. And in general, he's a horrific liar, but at least this administration there are members within it that are more open about being at war with Islam, and maybe in a way that in the long run might help us end it, because more people will realize it's deplorable.
Hopefully.
I'm not supposed to use that word anymore, are we?
No, it gets, as long as you don't call people deplorable, ideas are obviously deplorable, right?
So, okay. Yeah, I just thought that's what...
You're not referring to the people that hold those ideas as deplorable.
Yeah, the 2000 election was, are you allowed to call people deplorable? Are you allowed to call conservatives deplorable? That's really what it was. You could call liberals whatever fucking name you want.
Yeah, apparently it's just open season on that. Man, just there's some double standards there, but...
It's total fuck it. Well, that's like... That's all... See, that's why I kind of, you know... Like, sometimes I maybe take it too far or take it in the wrong direction, but I hate this equivalency between Republicans and Democrats, because there is such a double standard that the right holds for the rest of the world that aren't them. Like, the American right, the American conservative... It's just allowed to. It's just such privilege that it's just taken to this crazy, insane extreme. That as bad as the worst, I shouldn't say as the worst Democrat, but as like the establishment Democrats can be, and establishment kind of neoliberals in this country. It's just, I'm sorry, but the conservatives are just insane people. It's not even their policies; they're just insane human beings. That's what I really think. That I you know, it really gets harder and harder every day if you follow politics in America. And I know we're supposed to be reaching across the aisle. We're supposed to be fucking bipartisan. And I feel like I've had a couple drinks or something here. My tongue's getting looser. But it's just. I don't know. Like, what's the remedy to this? What's the
remedy? You don't compromise with crazy. I think that's one thing we can all agree on. Just don't compromise with crazy. If somebody is being, like, illogical and unreasonable, then they have no place in a reasonable conversation.
Yeah. But what... I mean, but if that's... The president and... I mean, yeah, it's easy to say, like, CNN shouldn't have trumpeters on or, you know, shit like that. But... Now that we've already gotten this far, and these people have fucking the biggest political radio shows in the country, and are in our families and our communities, like, what do we do? I don't know what to do. I don't want to just hate them. Like, I don't want to just hate them.
This is just a problem that's going to be sticking around for maybe a whole generation, unfortunately.
It is, because even if election-wise, from here on out, like, Trump was the pinnacle, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's see, pretend that the this brand of Republicanism, conservatism, is no longer as viable in elections. And they start doing poor, and maybe the party itself kind of changes. Maybe the Republican Party becomes the one that liberals want them to be. They're still going to be around. This is not. Yeah, this is at least a generation.
Yeah, we got to get rid of this. Like, I don't know, what do you call it? Like, zenith philosophy. Like, policies just have to be taken to their ultimate logical conclusion, and their most extreme conclusion, apparently.
Yeah. Well, I think that's just a human failing. It's like, if one is good, two is better. And I just... That's not... Like, other... You know... If two is good, three is better. So why don't we have three arms? You know, I mean, that's just not the way the world works. More isn't always better. Balance, you know. Watch fucking Star Wars or something.
We went off on a strange rant at the closing thought.
For lack of specific topics, that's
Well, you know, you look into the abyss that is John Kelly and his soul, and you're just kind of left wandering in the astral wastelands.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, do all those things that we told you to do at the beginning, in case you're only listening to the end of the podcast.
If you've made it this far.
If you've made it this far, come on, just invest a little more.
Right, just a click. Even just a rating.
A few clicks, a couple subscriptions, and I don't know.
You've probably formed an opinion about us in this time.
Tweet us, let us know where you listen to it, how you listen to it, what you'd like us to talk about, what rants you'd like us to stop having. Anyway, I'm Peter Elbro. You can find me on Twitter at @BloatedNemesis.
And I'm Charles Minnick. You can find me at @green_weird at WYRD.
And you can email the pod at tmwttpod@gmail.com. All right, this has been Tell Me What to Think. Thanks for listening. Have a fun week.
Stay safe.
And stay safe. And if you have an election, vote.
Alright, finally.
Today's the sunny, today's the rain. Destroy the myth that will break our chains. Break your chains!